Linda Law from University of Illinois. I'm the professor of Dallas and So I first knew when he was a graduate student. We were both actually graduate students in cosmology school in Santa Fe. So he was a student at University of San Diego back then. He finished his PhD in 2003 working on a novel method for detecting dark matter substructures, which is still remain invisible to us, and one of the fundamental predictions of dark matter paradigm. He was working on a novel way of detecting them back then as a graduate student. Then he won the prestigious Hubble Fellowship, and he took it to the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, where he overlapped for 1 year before he went to Princeton. And I think, I'm trying to remember, then we overlapped again. he went on to CETA, pick up a senior postdoctoral fellowship at CETA, and he was there until, I think, until he got his faculty position at the University of Illinois. So Neil has worked on a variety of cutting-edge issues in cosmology. He was basically one of, as I mentioned already, his substructure work. He made one of the most significant discoveries about how you can probe non-Gaussianities in galaxies arrays, and based on his work, when he was a postdoc at CETA, there are now hundreds of papers and many efforts that can now probe non-Gaussianity of the primordial initial conditions of our universe just as precisely or more precisely than cosmic microwave background does. And he's worked on a variety of topics, fundamental to understanding the structure of the universe and dark matter halos, and he's going to tell us about some of those today.
Thank you, Nagesh. That's a really kind interruption. So today my panel is to tell you guys about using galaxies for our purpose.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Bill. Do you mind turning on the power on the bell pack?
Yes,
thank you.
Sorry. Is that better?
No, now it's red. Is that better? No? Yes?
It was on.
Yes, it's on.
It's on now? Better? Okay, good. So, yes. So, just to recap what you missed, I'll be talking about using galaxies to probe fundamental physics, and I'm from Illinois. This work is done with a whole crew of people listed here from various different institutions. Just the main names that I want to highlight, though, so our two students at Illinois, Sushmita Adhikari and also Arko Banerjee, who are students at Illinois, they've done most of the work that I'll be describing today. Also, Yashar Hezeve, who's a postdoc, he's a Hubble Fellow at Stanford. He's been, so he's been leading lots of the lensing analysis that I'll describe towards the end of the talk if I have time. All three of them are currently on the market. They're all fantastic people. And so if you guys are looking for hiring great cosmologists, just keep their names in mind.
So there are four of them.
Oh, yeah, there's also a student at Stanford. He's not yet on the market. I have great hopes that in a few years he'll also be great, and also you should think about hiring him. You could also hire Norm Murray, but I mean, I don't know. He has his own obligations. Okay, so to get started. So the context for this work is shown here on this diagram that all of you have seen, I'm sure, a million times. Okay, so this diagram is showing both the past history as well as the future expansion of our universe in the context of our standard, lambda CDM model. Okay, so this diagram shows many important different epochs in our history. Okay, so first of all, so this diagram shows the epoch of inflation, cosmic inflation. This is the time when we think that the size of the universe grew exponentially in size over a short amount of time. It's also the period when the seeds of structure formation were first laid down as quantum fluctuations in the first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Subsequently, after this very earliest time, so these density perturbations then grew in amplitude over time, eventually developing into all of the structures that we see around us today, like galaxies, planets, people, hockey sticks, and so on. And then today, today is also a very interesting time. So today it appears that the Hubble expansion appears to be accelerating. Just very recently, this is a huge surprise to everyone back in its discovery. you know, just because gravity is normally thought to be attractive, and so this repulsive expansion was a huge surprise to everyone. Okay, so almost every single stage in this diagram is still mysterious to us in some way. Okay, so what I mean just is that so each stage here involves fundamental physics, which is still currently poorly understood. Okay, so for example, inflation, right? Okay, so we currently don't really understand very well the physics governing inflation, the mechanisms driving inflation. Similarly, following inflation, baryogenesis, the origin of the baryon, the origin of the baryonic symmetry is also poorly understood. We definitely do not understand the dark matter that is responsible for the development of cosmic structures over time. And dark energy, of course, remains a huge mystery to everyone. Okay. So the basic issue is that right now there's just lots and lots of uncertainty in this, our standard model of cosmology. Okay. And so given all this uncertainty, so to make progress and understanding what's needed, for us to make progress will be some new, like, powerful probes of cosmology, to help us understand, processes which previously currently remain mysterious, okay? And so in recent years, large-scale structure has proven to be an incredibly powerful, method of probing the conditions in the universe taking place across various different cosmic times. Okay, so for example, so it's well known that the generation of the initial perturbations during inflation is very sensitive to the conditions taking place back then. Very similarly, the evolution of those initial perturbations over time is, of course, very sensitive to the detailed microphysics of dark matter particles, the physics of dark energy, and so on. Okay, and so in this talk, I will be focusing on using large-scale structure as a probe of the physical processes that were taking place across all these different times. That's the sort of general plan for what to do. Okay, now so far to date, so far our best probe of large-scale structure just has been the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so the CMB just refers to the relic photons left over after the hot Big Bang. The temperature anisotropies in the CMB give us a two-dimensional snapshot of the conditions in the universe, so in a narrow window of time, roughly like a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, okay? So this picture shows our current best understanding of the cosmic microwave temperature anisotropies. This is measured by the Planck satellite. And so what's done is that we compute various statistics of these anisotropies. Okay, so things like endpoint correlation functions. And then what's done, by physicists then is to try to model these measured statistics to infer things like the physical parameters of the universe, the contents of the universe, the mechanisms taking place over time. Okay, and so in general, the CMB has proven to be just spectacularly useful for the purposes of studying physics across cosmic time. Okay, so it's like a fair statement to say that almost everything we know about cosmology, in some sense, derives from the cosmic microwave background. Okay, that being said, however, so CMB also has limitations. Okay.
Sorry, I guess better say can be derived from the microwave background. Well, historically, that wasn't the case.
That's right, but really, most of our modern understanding of all the parameters, like the age of the universe, expansion history, mean densities, the relative breakdowns of all the densities, the important processes. I mean, almost all of this really has come from, this sort of, measurements of the CMB power spectrum. I mean, as a non-CMB person, as a galaxy person, I, of course, obviously think that galaxies are useful as well, but it's still a mostly fair statement to say that the bulk of what we know about cosmology really has come from the CMB. This has been just spectacularly useful for us. That being said, though, it is still somewhat limited. The main limitation that I'll focus on is that the CMB only gives us a two-dimensional snapshot of the universe at a very certain time. The time of CMB last scattering. Okay, so therefore the CMB definitely does not contain all the information available to us inside of the observable universe. Okay, So therefore, we would like to have some other probes besides the CMB. Okay, so now what else can we do? Well, so astronomers like to observe things like galaxies. Okay, so what are galaxies? So galaxies are just these big, you know, beautiful collections of stars and gas and dark matter. There's many astronomers who like to study galaxies in their own right. Cosmologists like to use galaxies as interesting point-like tracers of the large-scale distribution of mass in the universe. Okay. So what's done is to measure the three-dimensional distribution of galaxies across the universe. One example is shown here. Okay, so this is showing the three-dimensional distribution of galaxies as measured by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the BOSS survey. Okay, so on this picture, every single dot represents a different galaxy like the Milky Way. Okay. And so then what we do then, from these galaxies just is to measure statistics like the power spectrum in the same way that we had measured the CMB power spectrum, okay? But our goal in doing this, of course, is to try to learn about the statistics of the underlying matter field as opposed to the galaxy field itself directly, okay? Just because the matter field itself is the quantity most closely related to the underlying physical processes. Okay. But just to stress again, right? So the advantage of using galaxies is that galaxies can provide us with full 3D information, and so therefore, in principle, galaxies in principle can provide more information than the CMB. Okay. This is the reason why lots of us like galaxies right now. Okay. So in principle, as I said, we can use galaxies to measure 3D structure. Okay. In practice, however, this is really, really hard for a variety of reasons, which I'll just briefly describe now. Okay, so one reason why it's really hard to use galaxies is that galaxies are intrinsically highly nonlinear objects. Okay, so what that means is that we have to use very messy nonlinear physics to try to understand how they evolve, how they behave. And typically, the method that we use to understand the nonlinear evolution of these galaxies is to use computer simulations. Okay, so the standard method is called n-body simulations on giant supercomputers. Okay, so one example of this is shown here. So this movie is showing an n-body simulation of, the formation of a cosmic structure. You can see lots of messy processes going on, right? So you can see all these horrible collisions and mergers. All these train wrecks going on. These processes all seem just impossible to understand analytically. Okay. So that's part of the reason why it's difficult to use galaxies. They are intrinsically, inherently nonlinear structures.
Is it just dark matter there?
Actually, yes. This was just a pure dark matter simulation. On top of this is also, in principle, for galaxies, you also, in principle, need to put in all the messy gas astrophysics, gastrophysics, things like the cooling of gas to make stars, the stars exploding, the stars feeding back on the rest of the gas, stuff coming in, going out, turbulence. Yeah, so, right. Okay, so this picture already looks like a horrendous mess. On top of that, we also have the even messier astrophysics of the baryons, which I will be neglecting throughout this talk, because otherwise we'll all start crying. So just messy, nonlinear. This is one reason why it's difficult to use galaxies. A second reason why it's hard to use galaxies is shown here. Okay. So to remind you, so the quantity that we want to know is the matter fluctuation field across space. Okay, that's the quantity most closely related to the basic physical processes. Unfortunately, of course, we cannot directly measure the matter fluctuations across space because most of the matter is dark matter. Dark matter we cannot see. So instead, what we do is to observe the galaxy fluctuations across space. Okay. Those two quantities are related to each other, but they are not the same. Okay, so you can see that this picture of the dark matter distribution in the simulation is not the same as this picture of the galaxy distribution in the same simulation. They resemble each other, but they're not the exact same. Okay, so an example of this is shown in this plot. Okay, so this scatter plot is just taking results from a simulation like this. Okay, so what was done just is to make a scatter plot of the galaxy overdensity at various different points in space and plot it against the dark matter, the mass density at each point in space. Okay, so the point just is that these two are related to each other. There is some relation between the two, but they are not the same as each other. Okay, so therefore, we cannot just simply use measurements of the observed galaxy density to tell us the underlying dark matter density. Instead, the best that we can do just is to say that there is some relationship between the galaxy perturbations, you know, right, so we can just write the galaxy perturbations as some, you know, as some generalized function of the matter perturbations, okay, you know, to reproduce this this behavior, which is seen in the simulations. Okay, that's the best we can do for now. Okay, now on large scales, okay, you know, so on large scales, the scatter in the mass and galaxy fluctuations is small, okay, you know, and so in cases where the scatter is small, we can Taylor expand this unknown function to lowest order. Okay, so to lowest order, we can write that the galaxy fluctuations at each point in space are just proportional to the matter fluctuations at that point in space with some constant of proportionality called the galaxy bias, okay? So this B is just literally the slope of this function evaluated at the mean density, okay? Yeah, so this B is called the galaxy bias, and this bias tells us the relationship between the quantity we observe, the galaxies, in terms of the quantity that we actually care about, the matter fluctuations in space. Okay, so for example, you know, so the galaxy power spectrum is just B squared times the matter power spectrum. Okay, okay, good. Now, an important result is that on large scales, okay, you know, okay, like, you know, so for scales larger than the formation scales of your objects, your galaxies, your tracers, whatever, okay, so for large scales, this bias B necessarily tends towards a constant independent of scale. Okay. So the statement is that on scales larger than the locality scale of the formation of your objects, the locality scale of the formation of your galaxies, okay? Okay, so for scales larger than that, this bias will tend towards a constant with corrections that are quadratic and k times r, okay? Okay, so this fact is really important, okay? This fact is a very robust prediction of just structure formation in general, okay? You know, so in general, you know, so it's really, really difficult to find cosmologies which break this behavior, okay? And so because of that, what that means is that therefore we can use this galaxy bias as a new robust tool to look for new kinds of physics that can break this behavior, okay? So does everyone follow what I'm saying, okay? A very robust prediction is that this quantity, the bias, tends towards a constant on large scales. It's almost impossible in normal cosmologies to break this behavior. Okay, so to break it, you have to violate locality. Good.
Easy way to break.
Ah, damn it, I have to rewrite my talk now.
Isocurvature fluctuation.
If the isocurvature fluctuations can affect how the galaxies are forming. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, right. Yes, yeah,
so
the key thing that you...
here, which is
adiabaticity, which is the normal prediction of a standard inflation models. Yeah, right. Yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, you know, so to break this again was needed, you know, so break this was needed is to violate the locality of the galaxy formation. Okay, so what that means is that forming galaxies here at this point in space depends only upon properties in this region of space, nowhere else.
Right.
Okay, yeah. Mark.
And this is even at large scales, there still would be terms quadratic in delta M with some constant, let's say C, but they're just small because delta M is small, right?
Right.
It's not that C has to be.
That's right. Right, but you can show in a EFT-like formulation of this that indeed those sort of terms can be reabsorbed in the end into this linear bias coefficient. Yeah. So again, right, so on large scales, these quadratic corrections become that much smaller. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So there's this whole program being done by many people, actually some of them here, to do resummation of these bias coefficients. Yeah. And this is a very interesting area of research, which I will not be.
I don't
think we did that. I was sure I saw people. I'm sure I've discussed this EFT stuff with people here, perhaps at a conference. It's hard to distinguish the conference people from the regular people because so many conference people coming through all the time.
Too many people.
Good. So my point is that this is a really robust way to look for new kinds of physics which are not present in the standard inflationary dark matter picture of structure formation. Okay, so this viewpoint that I'm describing is actually the exact opposite of the way that we normally think about galaxy biasing, okay? So normally we think of this bias as this like super annoying nuisance parameter, which is losing information, okay? So for example, right, so the uncertainty in this bias parameter B means that we can't use the measured amplitude of the galaxy power spectrum to know the amplitude of the matter power spectrum, just since there's just since there's this uncertain coefficient out front, okay? You know, so normally people think of this bias B as this like super annoying nuisance parameter. I'm instead going to argue to you that instead, you know, we should think of this, of this bias as actually a new source of, a new source of information, just because, again, for most standard cosmologies, this quantity is constant independent of scale. That's an easy prediction to test, okay, on large scales. Okay, very similarly, right, you know, so normally we often don't use small scales to probe cosmology just because a small scale structure is so messy, so nonlinear, okay? But again, though, right, you know, so in this talk I will argue to you that actually dealing with all of that mess, okay, I mean, so dealing with all of the mess of the nonlinearity, of the biasing, all of that can actually be really useful as a way to identify new kinds of probes of physics which people normally, normally overlook. Okay, and so what I'll do is to illustrate that with just some, three quick examples. Okay, so the examples that I'll focus on, so examples that I'll focus on are to use galaxies to probe inflation, galaxies to probe neutrino masses, and then galaxies as a probe of dark matter around galaxies. Okay, I am going a little bit late, so the last one might be kind of rushed. Okay, so first inflation. Okay, so inflation is obviously an epoch of tremendous interest and tremendous importance. Okay, so most of us think that inflation was indeed the epoch when, you know, the size of the universe grew exponentially in size soon after the Big Bang. We also think that the quantum fluctuations generating during inflation seeded all the structure that we see around us today. So all of the planets and people and desks and things, you know, formed initially out of quantum fluctuations and inflation. Okay, but of course inflation is still extremely poorly understood even today. You know, so we don't know if inflation was driven by something simple like a single slowly rolling scalar field, or perhaps something much, much more complicated. You know, we also don't even really know if inflation occurred at all, right? You know, so today there is many plausible, reasonable alternative models to inflation, which can also, these models can also account for, many of the same predictions, successes inflation has had, okay? So currently inflation still remains extremely poorly understood, okay? Now it's been known for a long time that a useful probe of the physics of inflation has been the statistics of the fluctuations that inflation produces, okay? And so in particular, the non-Gaussianity of the perturbations has been known to be extremely sensitive, to interesting physics taking place back in the early universe. Okay, so things like, for example, interactions among the amplitron field with itself or with other fields, the presence of multiple fields, violations of slow roll, and so on, okay? Yeah, and so for example, so last year there was this nice recent paper by Nima and Juan, talking about how we can think of, the sky as being sort of like providing, cosmological collider for us, okay? The idea here was to use non-Gaussianity seen on the sky, something like a collider experiment, letting us do, collisions in the sky, to probe interactions taking place back in the very earliest universe, okay? So an example of this, is the case of multi-field inflation, okay? Okay, so for models of inflation that have multiple fields, many of those models, robustly predict a specific form of non-Gaussianity, which couples long wavelength modes to the variance of the variance of modes on short scales. Okay. So this form of non-Gaussianity is called local non-Gaussianity. This form of non-Gaussianity is actually a very clear signature for the presence of multiple fields during inflation. Okay. And so, in fact, the detection of any non-zero amount of this form of non-Gaussianity would just immediately rule out the entire class of all single-field inflation models. Okay.
You mean like within the next regime of detection? Because there is a small amount of local non-Gaussianity predicted simply because the spectral index is not flat.
The NS minus one, you mean? Yeah, so there's been a lot of controversy about this. So my understanding was that the NS minus one is just a gauge artifact. So these papers by Matthias, I think, you know, arguing pretty convincingly that actually the NS minus one from Maldacena was just a gauge artifact. And that in the, you know, well, so in the actual redshift space observable, my understanding is that actually FNL, you know, the FNL would be explicitly zero, you know, so modulo nonlinear gravity. Yeah. I mean, I might be misunderstanding this, you know, this fact from Matthias, but that was my understanding from chatting with him last year. Might be true. Okay. So the claim is that any significant detection of this form of non-Gaussianity would just immediately rule out the entire class of single field inflationary models. Okay. So I want to stress how important that fact is, which is perhaps stupid to do here at Perimeter because this is like the home of non-Gaussianity, the home of inflation. Okay, you know,
this
but
is
it's
not the home of
certainly the home of non-Gaussianity. I've talked more non-Gaussianity here than anywhere else in the world. So just stress that this test is not just like this test is not just some simple like quantitative measurement. Okay, you know, so the statement is that a detection of non-Gaussianity would just qualitatively change understanding. You know, the understanding of how we think the early universe operated. Okay, you know, and so for that reason, many, many people are therefore keenly interested, you know, to measure these properties. Mark, you had a.
Is it really? I agree. It would. The standard picture would go away.
People would be like throwing themselves out their windows.
That's right. But it could still be single field, couldn't it? Like DBI inflation.
Absolutely. This. Oh no! Sorry. No. So this local non-Gaussianity, I think, excludes single field. You know, things like DBI generate a different form of non-Gaussianity. You know, this equilateral form of non-Gaussianity. Yeah, you know, so there's various different ways of breaking non-Gaussianity. This form is a diagnostic for multiple fields. Other forms are diagnostics for things like, you know, violations of slow roll, different, you know, bunch Davies vacuum state, things like that. Yeah.
I think I would disagree with it. It's way too hard. Inflation is not a theory that can be ruled out. So even single field inflation, all I've got to do is add some other field that gets fluctuations during inflation.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't affect the inflation at all.
Right.
But it just sits as a background spectator.
That's right.
Later it gives you non-Gaussian.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you would not count that as single field.
Exactly. So, exactly.
The second you detect there will be 1,000 inflation models.
It's like curviton, for example, would be like this, right? Yeah, exactly.
So it's true.
So curviton, I would call as multi-field inflation. Yeah.
Yeah, but.
So single field, we think
You're presenting it as if this is a theory. It's not really a theory. It's a totally adjustable paradigm,
which will instantly be
adjusted to match any conceivable observation.
Yes, so inflation as a paradigm has many types of possible modes of behavior. What I'm saying, though, is that the currently favored simplest, you know, mode that, you know, maybe just the one which people, due to personal reasons, favor, due to like simplicity, just is single field, slow roll, scalar field inflation. Okay, you know, most papers that you see refer to that. And I'm saying that that specific class.
It's a framework. It's a framework which could be adjusted to match almost any conceivable observation.
The moment you throw out curviton to multi-field inflation, it's hard to. I mean, as long as the Higgs isn't your inflaton, you're sort of guaranteed some level of non-Gaussianity from fluctuations in just inflation.
Occam's preferred inflation.
Maybe the point here is not about inflation. The point is that was there a second degree of freedom or were there multiple degrees of freedom?
Right.
And that's the thing. So we see it's really a mathematician that you mentioned.
It's much more general than inflation.
Fair enough.
But the conditions are debatic or not.
Very good. Yeah, that's right.
Whatever mechanism made fluctuations in the universe, the distinction between free theory and an interacting one is fundamental. And that's what this is. It's actually nothing to do with inflation.
No, that's right. Yeah. I mean, right. So for alternative theories besides inflation, you know, the same similar calculations can be done, thereby also testing the series. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I guess as just most people are familiar with inflation, and so it's nice to phrase things in that way. But I can see that maybe for an expert audience, maybe phrasing things in terms of inflation might lead to some controversy. Okay, good. So, so the point is that this is why a lot of people are working really hard to try to detect this sort of non-Gaussianity, because it's telling you something very deep, fundamental about the conditions back in the very early universe. Okay, so what's the current status? The current status is that from a cosmic microwave background Planck, so the current measurements on the amount of this non-Gaussianity, so parameterized by this one number called FNL. Okay, so the current constraints are that FNL is greater than about 5. So, so to orient you, so an interesting, threshold value for FNL, to distinguish different kinds of models, so it might be FNL around 1 or so. Okay. So Planck is getting close to the really interesting regime. Okay. However, though, Planck is probably not going to, improve this, significantly in the future in the CMB. Okay. So besides the CMB, of course, we also have other upcoming surveys. Okay. So for example, galaxy surveys are now finally starting to make measurements of the three-point function of galaxies. Okay. But given the bias effects that I talked about earlier in the talk. Okay. So one obvious question is whether or not there are any new signatures besides just the three-point function in galaxies, that we can use, to probe these sort of non-Gaussianities, so using galaxies. Okay. Okay. Right. So that was the motivation. Okay. So back in 2008, my colleagues at CETA and I were just thinking about, these sort of non-Gaussian models, and so we realized that actually non-Gaussianity should actually make an enormous effect on the spatial clustering of galaxies. Okay, so what we showed was that this sort of local non-Gaussianity should make an enormous correction to this bias quantity B at at low k on large scales. Okay, so to remind you, the normal behavior in just standard cosmologies is that this bias B is just a constant independent of k at low k. And so what we showed was that in the presence of this sort of local non-Gaussianity, the galaxy bias gets a correction with scales like 1 over k squared. So therefore, this correction diverges as you go towards, the largest scales probed in your, in your survey. Okay. And so what this means is that, so even for like moderate values of this FNL, you can still get extremely large, like order unity effects on the galaxy bias, and so therefore also order unity effects on the power spectrum of the galaxies. Okay. Okay. So again. Okay. Right. So 2 points. Okay. So first you can see. First you can see that the effects can be enormous on large scales. Okay. The second effect I want to stress is that this is showing up in the two-point function of galaxies, even though the two-point function of matter has no such effect. Okay. This effect is specific to things like galaxies. It does not show up in the matter field. And therefore, it shows that there is, in fact, benefit in thinking about the messiness of actually forming galaxies as a way to find new signatures of fundamental physics. Okay. This is just a picture showing how it looks in real space. I'll skip through this. Okay. So because this effect is so large, so because this effect is so large and it's also so hard to mimic using normal conventional physics, and what it means is that therefore, so with surveys we can actually place really tight constraints on the values of these non-Gaussianity parameters. Okay, so that's shown here. This plot is stolen from the SphereX white paper. Okay, so SphereX is this proposed galaxy satellite mission aimed at measuring non-Gaussianity really. Okay, so SpheriX is a SMEX mission, which means that it's really cheap, should fly really fast.
So when is that going to happen, or how about the action of the satellite?
Yeah, so this year is the down select. So SpheriX is competing with these two X-ray polarimetry satellites. So, I mean, obviously the science here is more interesting than the science in X-rays. Yeah, who cares, right? You know, but there are some political reasons to worry. I mean, X-ray is kind of dying right now in astronomy, and so people want to maintain the community of people who can build X-ray satellites. And, okay, anyway, this is beyond the topic of this.
Really so tough. Is somebody making a Brian trap down.
Is the origin of this a primordial warpoint function with a 1 over K1 plus K2 cube? What is the origin of the...
Oh, where did this come from?
Right.
Where does this 1 over k
so
squared bias come from?
It's a four-point function, is that right?
No, so it's a three-point function. Right. So, okay, so one way to think about this, is that the three-point function couples the amplitude of a long wavelength mode with the variance of modes on short wavelengths. Mm-hmm. Okay, the variance affects how many small objects will form. Okay, and so the bias is just, the dependence of the formation of small objects given the presence of a long wavelength mode.
Okay,
yeah, right, okay. So for this local long Gaussianity, the expressions actually simplify quite dramatically. And so you can show that the fluctuations, the delta in these galaxies traces the matter delta, B times delta matter, as well as a B times the potential, phi, which is delta over K squared. And that K squared is this K squared. Yeah. So the argument, right. So the argument that we use here for this local non-Gaussianity can also be applied for any non-Gaussianity. Okay. The expressions are not quite as simple as just 1 over K squared, but the exact same arguments go through. Okay. And so similar to this, local non-Gaussianity is also other forms of non-Gaussianity, like this, like this orthogonal, non-Gaussianity, and they also produce this sort of large scale deviations from the bias. Okay. Anyway, okay, so the point here is that these contours much, much tinier than the Planck contours. Okay, so therefore, this effect can be used to dramatically improve our knowledge of the amount of non-Gaussianity taking place in the early universe. Okay, which is important again because, as I said, any non-zero detection of this effect would just qualitatively modify how we understand what was taking place early on. Okay, good. So So the point is that this non-Gaussianity, what it does is that it gives us an example for how we can use messy galaxy astrophysics to reveal new kinds of interesting effects coming from coming from fundamental physics. Okay, so to remind you, the reason why this happened from non-Gaussianity was that the non-Gaussianity is violating the locality of the formation of galaxies. Okay. Non-Gaussianity is coupling regions from here and here, thereby breaking the locality of forming galaxies over here. That's the key thing, okay? However, though, non-Gaussianity is not the only way to break locality, okay? So in fact, any species that travels large distances can also break locality. And so, for example, one species like that is the neutrino, okay? So that then brings us to the next topic, which is neutrino masses with galaxies.
The other thing is that photons of course can travel large
distances. Exactly. Photons also travel large distances. Fortunately or unfortunately for us, photons are massless, and so their gravity is almost negligible for forming galaxies.
But they do ionize the universe.
They do ionize the universe, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so for things like the colors of galaxies, you might wonder about large scale biasing coming from bubbles of ionization probably over large distances. So people have looked for this quite extensively,
right.
And so far from what we can tell, galaxy formation does indeed seem to be local on scales of 10 megaparsecs. Yeah.
Theoretically or
observationally. So I mean that in a technical sense, which I can maybe describe offline. Yeah. Okay, good. So neutrinos could also do the same effect. Okay, so first let's just review what are neutrinos in case people don't remember. Okay, so neutrinos are just these, neutral particles which can participate in the weak reaction. But the most interesting thing about them is that they're also incredibly light particles. Okay, so their masses are something like a million times less than the mass of an electron. So currently it is still unclear as to why the masses of neutrinos are so tiny compared to the masses of anything else. There is currently lots of proposed reasonable ideas for why masses of neutrinos are so small. So, for example, I mean, so there's things like the seesaw mechanism, which relates to electron, which relates to neutrino mass, the Higgs mass, and also gut scale masses. Okay, but before we try to understand the origin of the masses of neutrinos, the first step actually just is to measure what are the actual masses of neutrinos. Okay, now so far, so far we have not been able to actually directly measure neutrino masses in the laboratory. Okay, we have been able to measure the differences in the mass squares of neutrinos thanks to oscillation experiments, but the actual absolute mass level is still uncertain experimentally. Fortunately, however, though, it turns out that actually cosmology appears well poised to actually just directly measure the absolute actual masses of neutrinos in the very near future. Okay? And so the way that this works is that neutrinos just suppress the growth of this structure in the dark matter in baryons over time. Okay, so this picture shows you an example. These different curves show what happens as you dial up or dial down the amount of neutrinos. The main effect that you can see is that having more and more neutrinos suppresses the growth of dark matter structures on small scales. Okay, and so therefore, then a measurement of this power spectrum therefore constrains how much neutrinos there are. That's the normal standard way that cosmology uses to constrain neutrino masses. Okay, very similarly, right? So the same kind of physics can also be used to constrain things which things which are similar to neutrinos. Okay. So for example, some models like dark radiation, okay? Just one very cute example of this comes from this, cute recent paper coming from Nima and his collaborators, okay? So in this paper, and so what was done was to propose a novel mechanism to solve the Higgs hierarchy problem. Their model just generically predicts a whole zoo of species that are like neutrinos, okay? And so my student and I have been calculating the effect of that whole zoo of neutrinos on the development of cosmic structures over time, okay? And so the point is that, so similar to the effects of the normal neutrinos, these sort of, similar dark radiation species can also, modify the growth of structure over time, meaning that measurements of structure formation thereby can constrain these sort of, departures from standard physics.
What is M5?
So this phi was the Riheton particle. So I don't want to get into the details of their specific model. So the basic idea, in this model is that there are like n copies of the standard model. They all have different Higgs masses. The lightest Higgs mass is us, okay? The other copies are not dominantly reheated after inflation. This is why we, dominate energy density in the universe, but the neutrinos in these other copies can have significant energy densities. And it turns out that, so it turns out that for a wide range of the parameter space, those extra dark neutrinos can actually significantly affect structure formation.
They don't affect the helium abundance?
No, not helium, but they can affect an effective.
And why wouldn't they affect helium?
This
usually gives a constraint. There can't be more than a certain number of these particles.
Oh! You mean from the expansion history?
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, right. Okay. Yeah.
Doesn't that limit the number?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, yeah. I mean, so in their paper, they quote their constraints in terms of n effective,
okay.
And presumably n effective less than 3.2 or something. I would imagine would not affect helium significantly.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Would not.
It would not. Yeah. Okay. Go
ahead. I mean, the CMB has pretty much tighter constraints than that.
For ineffective, right?
Region,
yeah, exactly. Right. Okay. Yeah, I know. And so, given those tight constraints on ineffective,
it's not degenerate. So there could be things that lower ineffective, but for helium it goes that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe. Okay. Okay. Well, in any case, so given the constraints on ineffective, we then were checking to see if there'd be effects on the growth of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, there are some effects on growth of structure. And so my student is currently working on, seeing how well we can actually quantify this with surveys like LSST and so on.
Is there a way to tell bosons from fermions here? Because if there's ultralight scalar, then it produces similar.
Yes. Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, very good. Okay, so in the paper, it's in the paper. This is section 5 of his paper. Section 6 is actually on, is actually on that, distinguishing bosons from fermions.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the linear regime, at high K, there are indeed significant differences you know, in the power spectrum. Mm-hmm. It is unclear if those high K linear differences will survive to the present day once we have nonlinearities kicking in. You know, but if we had, you know, very high redshift measurements, you know, say maybe Chime or perhaps even earlier redshift with 21 centimeter, it might be possible to look for these subtle differences.
But neutrinos are fermions, so what do you mean by photons versus?
Okay, so dark radiation is just things like neutrinos. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, right, so for models like asymmetric dark matter, for example, there can be dark radiation species. You might want to know if they are bosonic or fermionic. And
but
it turns out
it's slightly different. If you have ultralight scalar, yeah. Compton wavelengths of the sizes.
Oh, yes, yeah, so things like fuzzy dark matter as well. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yes, yeah, so that's also something we're working on, which I will sadly not be able to get to, I can see. Okay, well, so let me just move on. Okay, so as I said, so the usual strategy for probing these sort of neutrinos is to look for their suppression of the matter power spectrum. Okay, but our goal here in this talk is to look for new effects of these sort of neutrinos using galaxies. Okay, so I mentioned before that the fact that the neutrinos stream large distances, what this means is that they can in principle generate this, you know, this biasing effect on large scales. Okay, so because of that, you know. So my student and I decided to look for this biasing effect in simulations that have massive neutrinos. So we tried, and we got total disaster immediately. So it turns out that our standard tool for actually computing nonlinear structure formation with neutrinos, that standard tool turns out to make enormous errors, errors at the factors of million or billion level, you know, in simulations, okay? So for those of us who are in the, you know, age of precision cosmology, factors of a million are just, you know, slightly, you know, beyond the pale. Okay.
Better than 120 orders of
magnitude. I'm at perimeter. That's right. Just say all of perfect agreement. less than 10 orders of magnitude. Exactly. It's fine tuning to get so good. So these pictures illustrate the problem that I'm talking about. Okay. So what's shown here is the power spectrum. You know, the power spectrum for particles in a warm dark matter simulation, okay? Just warm dark matter, the exact same error that happens for neutrinos also happens here, okay? Okay, you know, so this red curve shows the initial power spectrum in the simulation. The main thing to see is that at high K, there's this enormous suppression of power due to the streaming of particles over large distances, erasing small scale structure. Okay, the next curve shows a somewhat later snapshot in time in the simulation. You can see that just immediately, all this power has been filled in. Okay, right, so the power spectrum has grown by factors of like millions or billions, okay? All of this is total junk. This is all pure numerical errors, okay? The exact same effect happens for neutrinos, okay? So on this plot, for example, okay, like, you know, so this black curve shows what the actual neutrino power spectrum should be at a redshift of 20 or something, okay? For comparison, the black curve, the dotted curve, shows what the n-body simulation gives for the power spectrum of neutrinos. And again, you can see like 6 orders of magnitude error, okay? This problem is absolutely generic to all these n-body simulations. If people are curious, I can explain sort of roughly why this happens, okay? But this problem has been around for decades, and it has basically stopped us from making progress in this field. Okay, so my student and I, being neophytes, we thought, okay, well, you know, let's just take a look at this problem and see if we can solve it. 1 year later, so we finally, you know, think settled on a solution which seems to fix these factors of billion problems. In the interest of time, maybe I'll skip through the details of how the method works. If you're curious, come ask me. We have all these various different tests, you know, for the method. So for example, so this plot is showing that same test I showed you before. Okay, you know, it's just showing the evolution of the power spectrum in the linear regime. N-body was giving us errors at the millions of level, okay, whereas this method agrees, you know, exactly. Okay, we also did some tests of the nonlinear structure formation and also worked really well. Okay, so now that we finally have a method which works, we can finally simulate some actual cosmologies that have massive neutrinos. Okay, some examples of this are shown here. This is a light neutrino, this is a heavier neutrino. Key thing you can see is that the lighter neutrino is much more diffuse, much less clustered compared to a heavier neutrino, as you might expect, because they're moving around so fast. Okay, so now we have working simulations. Okay, So our first original goal was to look for this biasing effect in these simulations of neutrinos. Okay? So our goal was to look for this scale dependence of the bias of galaxies caused by the non-locality of the neutrinos. Okay, so sadly in our simulations, what we found was that in galaxies four, so four realistic neutrinos, the biasing effect on the galaxies is really tiny, like your percent level. Okay, the basic problem just is that for most normal galaxies, fast moving neutrinos basically do not cluster inside of them. Okay. However, though, there are other structures that form in cosmology besides galaxies, okay? So for example, one structure, which is very interesting, which forms is a cosmic void. What's a void? A void is just a big empty region of space without galaxies in it. We're now seeing lots of these voids in imaging surveys like DES and so on. Okay, so based on some arguments that we worked out, we expected that these voids should actually have a significant biasing effect much larger than the galaxies, and we checked. And indeed, we do see this enormous biasing effect for the voids. Okay, so this is plotting, again, the bias B versus K. Okay, so without neutrinos, it's just scale dependent, the normal way, normal physics. If you have these neutrinos streaming large distances, you can get enormous scale dependence in the bias. Okay, this figure may seem like super amazing. One thing I should stress is that in these simulations, what was done was to artificially dial up the number of neutrinos by a factor of 10, okay? So the actual effect from this will be 10 times smaller than this, just so you know, okay? However, though, even dividing this by a factor of 10, this is still an order unity change in the bias.
What about neutrino mass are you assuming?
The minimal neutrino mass.
0.05.
What distinguishes red from green?
Yeah, so these are two different kinds of voids, yeah.
Okay. Types of voids?
Yeah. Yeah, so the ones which are lensing overdent versus lensing underdent. Yeah.
What is a negative bias?
Sorry?
The vertical axis is a bit strange.
Sorry?
You still got B tote of K.
Yes.
Why is it negative?
Yes, because these are anti-bias relative to matter.
Oh.
So a region which is overdense in matter will be underdense in voids because it has more mass in it and therefore more galaxies, fewer voids. Yeah. Okay. Until you get neutrinos, which can actually flip the sign, right? It's crazy. So again, we can get these order unity effects on the bias, okay? And again, galaxy surveys are now getting a percent level precision measuring these sort of quantities. And so therefore, order unity is definitely in the realm of being observable in the near future, okay? And so our team is currently working really hard with the dark energy survey to look for this effect in the voids which they are already finding. And so our hope is that we can really soon have interesting constraints on the masses of neutrinos. I want to stress that, it's important to stress that this method, this method using void clustering, this is entirely independent of the normal method to measure, to measure neutrino masses from the suppression of the matter power spectrum, okay? Okay, so this is crucial to do, right? So for cosmologists to measure neutrino masses in a way that will convince particle physicists, we must have multiple independent probes which both give the same answer. Absent that, I think no one will believe us when we say that we measured mu of, six electrons.
In what sense is it independent? So you're
it's an entirely different signal, okay? So the normal signal just is to see the suppression of the CMB lensing amplitude. It's just one number. No scale dependence. Here, what we're looking for is the shape, the scale dependence, okay? And the form of the shape dependence depends only on the mass of the neutrino, okay? So all that matters here...
Is it proportional to the mass, or do you not have...
So what matters here is the streaming scale of the neutrinos, okay? So on scales larger than the streaming scale, the bias will become constant, again, independent of scale. On scales below the streaming scale, there will be a scale dependence. Okay, so all that matters here is the mass of the neutrino. It is setting the shape of this curve.
What power of the mass that we've got? Is it linear in the mass?
Oh, you mean how does the streaming scale with mass?
No, I mean the amplitude of the effect.
No. Sorry. Okay, no. So the amplitude depends upon the types of voids you're looking at. The signal here is the shape of the effect.
So I guess I'm saying if I double the mass of the neutrinos, how does the effect cut out?
So if you double the mass of the neutrino, this curve will shift left and right. You cannot say what the amplitude will do. The amplitude is a number you don't even care about. The amplitude depends upon the astrophysics of the voids. What I'm saying, though, is that the shape contains all of the mass information. Okay? It's the shape that's telling you the free streaming scale.
But that's what I'm saying, because that's the shape dependent, the constant part, forget about it, the part that depends on k.
Yes.
Right? But like in the case of non-Gaussianity,
right.
It's proportional to
f 1 over k squared.
F and n divided by k squared, right? That's what it was in non-Gaussian.
That's right.
So here, it's neutrino mass times some function of k.
That's right, yeah. You know, so here what matters, you know, is the total mass fraction of neutrinos,
okay,
so right? But it also depends upon the void you're looking at, okay? You know, those two things will be degenerate with each other.
It's something like 1 over 1 plus kr squared, where r is the streaming length.
Well,
as you go to very large scales, there's no effect.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, so what matters really here for this is the, you know, I mean, so what matters here, you know, just is the, you know, the ratio of the transfer function, the linear transfer function of neutrinos compared to the dark matter transfer function as a function of k. At low k, these are the same dependence. At high k, they're different than each other.
So it's 1 over 1 plus k squared, something like that. So it's
So this is, you know, falling off in some way. This is, you know, doing something much more gradual,
mm-hmm.
right? And is this shape dependence,
mm-hmm.
okay? That's what's driving this shape dependence, okay? But the key thing is that it is the shape of this curve telling you the mass of the neutrino.
If it went to even lower k's, your red curve and green curves would go to constants.
They would go to constants, which are different than each other.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly, that's right.
And they go to constants at the neutrino free streaming length, right?
Sorry?
They would bend flat at the neutrino streaming length.
Exactly. That's the scale setting the difference in these transfer functions.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Okay, good. It's nice to have an audience who can follow. Okay, I am rapidly running out of time. Okay, so just the key point here is that this is, yet again, another example of how messy astrophysics can be useful for probing fundamental physics. What I'm saying is that there is value in actually dealing with the mess. Don't just treat it as some effective parameter that you marginalize over. There's actually gold to be mined in this astrophysics. I was going to talk about dark matter substructure. I see I am out of time. So maybe I'll just say that we're also trying to probe dark matter substructures using an effect called gravitational lensing. Okay, so substructures just mean all these little dark matter, you know, clumps, subhalos that are orbiting around galaxies like the Milky Way. There are very strong predictions in normal cosmologies for how much substructure there should be. And that amount of substructure is very strongly dependent on the microphysics of dark matter particles. So for example, so if you have like, you know, fuzzy dark matter, warm dark matter, self-interacting dark matter, all of these variations of dark matter will all produce significant changes in the amount of this substructure. So therefore, we are keenly interested to know how much substructure there actually is. There have been attempts by astronomers to quantify how much substructure there is. What they do is to count galaxies, making the assumption that every subhalo has a galaxy inside of it. If you make the assumption that every subhalo has a galaxy inside of it, what you find is a huge deficit, a huge discrepancy between the expected number of dark matter subhalos compared to the observed number of satellite galaxies. This is called the missing satellites problem. This is like the biggest problem in cosmology for the past 20 decades, past two decades. Some people think that this, you know, this is evidence for new physics in the dark sector. We are less convinced. The reason is that these little dark matter subhalos might be present, but just are missing stars, missing galaxies in them. Okay, and so we've been trying to actually search for these little low mass lumps around typical galaxies using an effect called gravitational lensing. I will spare you the beautiful, beautiful description of how this works. I'll just show you our first results, okay? You know, so earlier this year, our team has a program to image a large number of these gravitational lens objects to look for a substructure around them, okay? This is the very first system that we published. In this system, we found at 7 sigma confidence a subhalo living at this location, 7 sigma. We also had an almost detection. We had a 4.5 sigma almost detection of a subhalo living at this location. Wasn't quite 5 sigma, so we didn't call it a detection. Okay. If we translate all of our detections and also all of our non-detections over the other areas, okay, we can then derive constraints on the mass function of dark matter subhalos. Okay. So all this just comes from our one system. Okay, so obviously the error bars are still large. Okay, so these arrows and the error bar, that shows the constraints from this one system. Okay, for comparison, this band shows the constraints from all previous measurements, of all previous measurements of substructure. Point I want you to take away is that this one system by itself analyzing a subset of its data already is competitive with all previous measurements. One system.
Where's the prediction?
Very good. This is the prediction. Okay. So these bands show the expected amount of dark matter substructure for this galaxy. The expected amount of substructure depends upon what is the mass of the galaxy. We do not know the mass of the galaxy yet. We are working on it. So this shows different choices for the range of the mass. We believe that it's a 10 to the 13th solar mass halo. We don't know. Okay. So this is showing a factor of 10 either way in mass, to be conservative. Okay, so you can see how the prediction varies over that range. Okay. Key point though is that already we are in the interesting regime. This is one system. We already have four more in the can observed. We have four more being observed later on this month. In total, we have 100 of these systems waiting to be observed. Okay. So I want to stress that we have sensitivity at the mass ranges where we have missing satellites in the Milky Way. Okay? So a factor of 100, we will definitively answer whether or not there are missing subhalos around typical galaxies like the Milky Way. So these are typically at redshifts around a half or so. I mean, there's a range, obviously, but typically like a half or so. Okay? Somewhat more massive than the Milky Way. Okay? But again, though, the same exact substructure problem that happens in the Milky Way also happens in all these galaxies. Okay. So just the point is that in the very near future, we will have a definitive answer to the missing satellites problem. Okay, so I'll just stop here and summarize just the key points. Galaxies are useful, not just a mess, not just a nuisance parameter. It's actually interesting physics you can learn by actually treating them in detail. I mentioned three examples: inflation, neutrinos, dark matter substructure. Okay, and I'll stop there. Sorry for going over.
Is to ask
science
students or any students actually to ask the best question. Is there any brave student here?
I promise to put the stick down. I won't.
Yeah, there you go.
You were talking about how you would use the three-dimensional power spectrum of galaxies to try to see whether there are primordial non-gaussianities.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess redshift space distortions will, disturb that procedure significantly. So can you say anything about to what kind of uncertainties redshift space distortions?
Yes, we wouldn't necessarily expect distortions to affect what we're saying, okay? The distortions just move the locations of the objects that form into redshift space compared to where they formed, right? But the actual number of them isn't really changing. So what happens in the distortion is that it produces anisotropy. So it breaks the isotropy of the clustering in 3D. Okay, so all that will certainly still happen. There will certainly still be distortions happening in redshift space. But again, though, the corrections will be the same as usual, okay, right? So for example, right, for things like the Kaiser distortion limit, right, okay? So normally, we say that the orbit density of galaxies in redshift space is something like, the galaxy bias plus B, F mu squared times the real space orbit density, right? Okay, so all I'm saying is that now this B gets a correction, but this remains unchanged, okay? The equivalence principle hasn't changed. So therefore, this F mu squared has not changed. If you modify gravity or something crazy like that, then maybe you can have interesting effects on the distortion.
Other questions? Yes.
Can you kind of go over how galaxy voids can be used to prove neutrino masses?
Yeah. Sorry, that was a bit fast because I noticed I was half an hour or too slow. I'm not sure how that happened. Okay, so I mentioned before that for species that can violate locality of the formation of that object, okay, that can cause the large-scale bias of that object to become non-constant. Okay, So our hope was that neutrinos would do this for galaxies, okay? In practice, though, they didn't really have a large effect just because neutrinos don't really affect the formation of galaxies very significantly. The reason for this is actually the following really simple thing, okay? You know, so inside of a galaxy, the overdensity in mass, okay, you know, typically is something like, you know, 200, you know, maybe like, you know, 10 to the 4, something like this, okay, a huge number, okay? The overdensity in neutrinos in these objects is a number of order unity, okay? So therefore, the effect neutrinos have on the formation of these objects is really tiny. It's down by this ratio. Okay, so in principle, the same thing could be happening in these voids, right? Okay, you know, so these voids are just sort of like anti-galaxies, okay? Right, okay, right, like, you know. So these galaxies form out of, you know, initial peaks of the density field. These voids form out of initial, like, troughs or anti-peaks, okay? But one difference, though, between voids and galaxies is the following, okay? You know, okay, I mean, right, you know, so for, you know, so for the voids, again, the neutrino underdensity will, you know, again, will be of order unity, okay? However, though, and this is a minus, order minus one, okay? However, though, in a void, the dark matter underdensity is bounded from below by minus one, okay? So you can never reach these 200, 400 levels of underdensity just because the physical density is positive, okay? Oh, I'll just remind you, this delta, so this just means delta rho over rho, okay, you know, right, you know, which is, you know, rho local minus rho bar over rho bar, okay? So the worst you can get is that this is zero, giving you minus one for delta. Okay, so therefore, this ratio of the underdensities of neutrinos and voids is not orders of magnitude less than it is in the galaxies. And that's why the effect on the voids can be much, much larger than the effect on the galaxies. And that's why then we looked for this effect, and then indeed we did, you know, indeed see this enormous.
Of course, it is suppressed by the fraction of the mass density in the neutrino.
Yes, on top of all of this, there is this F nu factor. Exactly, that's right, which is order percent. That's right, that's right. But again, this accounted for that, except that I multiplied by a factor of 10. Okay, right. But again, though, just divide this by 10, and it's still order unity. Yeah.
Right. Good. Other questions?
I mean, qualitatively, it makes the voids less sharp. Because
it's true. I mean, right. So
because basically the neutrinos are filling the void.
They are partially filling in the void. That's exactly right. Okay, and that's the origin of this biasing. Okay, you know. So what happens is that, you know, so regions which have large scale neutrino over densities, their voids are more filled in, and there's fewer of them in those regions.
Yes.
Regions that have large scale neutrino under densities, they are less filled in, giving you more voids. Yeah. And because the neutrinos have a different power spectrum than dark matter, right, and therefore this appears to us as a scale-dependent bias. That's exactly right.
Any questions? Well, we already had quite a few questions during talk and interruption. So if there are any more, then let's thank Anil again.